Hello, everybody. I'm Colin.
And my name is Javen.
And this is the Abstract Podcast, where we talk about ideas that matter.
This week on the show, Colin sits down and has a conversation with Dr. Herringer, who teaches here at Toccoa Falls College. Dr. Herringer has been here on campus since 2017. He has earned a bachelor's degree from St. Olaf College, his master's degree from Duke Divinity School, and his PhD from the Fuller Theological Seminary.
We are also sponsored by Hirschberger's Bakery in Fairplay, South Carolina, right off of Interstate 85, where in addition to pastries, they also have a wonderful selection of lunch sandwiches such as burgers, chicken salad sandwiches, ham sandwiches, the works. So stop by and grab a great sandwich.
Yeah, so what did Dr. Herringer think of the bread? Because I know he's a big bread guy. When I was in his class, he was always telling us about how he makes the bread. Did he seem impressed with the loaf?
Well, he was very thankful for it, so that says something about
it. We'll have to ask him how good it was. I'm sure it was great. Next up is Colin's conversation with Dr. Herringer.
Well, I'm here with Dr. Herringer. First off, thank you so much for coming by.
Really appreciate it. Glad to be here.
Yeah, it is an honor to have you. The reason I wanted to have you on is Javen mentioned to me that he heard you were doing a class on the theology of race and ethnicity. Mm-hmm. And that piqued my interest a little bit. And so I just wanted to have you on talk about race a little bit and the theology of race. So first off, we call it the Abstract Podcast, and it's our slogan is we talk about ideas that matter, but more from a 30,000 feet. We don't ever quite get down all the way and land the plane. So I would just be curious, first of all, your class is called the Theology of Race and Ethnicity, correct?
Yes.
Could you just give us a 2-minute abstract or thesis of what you are trying to accomplish with that class?
Yeah. The class is trying to say, looking around the culture today, around the world today, race is becoming and has become, a very important topic, right? We think of Black Lives Matter. We think of the discussions that are going on about, policing and people of color. We look around the ideas of immigration. This isn't in the wider world today, but we look maybe 4, 5, 6 years ago, a lot of discussions were about and where do we want immigrants to come from, right? There are certain immigrants that are better than other immigrants, and was that about their race? And the idea behind it was all these things are happening in culture today, these discussions are happening, and does Christian theology have anything to speak into those discussions? Does Christian theology changed the discussion in any ways? What ways can Christians be informed by those discussions that are happening? In what ways should we speak into those discussions that are happening? And just giving students some time to think and talk and discuss the issues that are often untalked about, right? These are not issues that we sit down at night and talk with our friends about easily. These are hard and complicated and complex issues. So that's the sort of the general idea of the class.
Yeah, that's great. The next question kind of leads right into that. Why should Christians care about racial reconciliation? That's a big question, but the reason I ask that is because sometimes you'll hear the response that the Bible actually is a racist book. That can be more of the secular critique when you have verses like slaves obey your masters, as Paul writes, I think that's Galatians, and some of the household codes. What is your approach to looking at why a Christian should care about racial justice? Like, what's the foundation of that?
Yeah, just so before we get to that, the quick question on some of the critiques. When Paul is speaking about slavery, that's a whole separate question, but just very simply, slavery is not a racialized thing when Paul is writing. It was about economics and war and battle. And so it's a little different than American slavery.
It's not your chattel
slavery. Yeah, you don't want to read into that. And then, what Paul's position on slavery is complex, right? I don't think he's condoning slavery anyways. If you read Philemon, he's doing everything he can, right, to get Onesimus set free. And so that's you know, I think there's some complex discussions they had there. But your broader question was something like, why does theology, what was your broader question?
Why should Christians care about racial justice?
Okay, well, that's it. That is a very broad, we're at abstract here. We're at 10,000 feet. Because of God and Jesus. Let's start at the beginning, right? Because of creation. God created humans in the image of God. There is value to that. There is innate value that cannot be taken away. There is no discussions of, you know, race as we think of it today in those verses. And just to start with, humans who are created in the image of God are valuable, invaluable, and should be treated as such. And so, you know, just if you start there, it's hard to get anywhere racist. Mm-hmm. Does that make sense? And it is pushing us to be anti-racist, because we have at our core this idea of God creating all humans in God's image, and thus of infinite value and worthy of love and respect and honor, and wanting them to thrive and wanting them to, you know, grow in all ways that are possible. And so any sorts of forms of injustice where someone's humanity is questioned or doubted, or where there are rankings of humans based on skin color or other criteria that those things seem to fall away in the passages of scripture that seem to say God, that says God creates in his image. And so that's one reason. And then, you know, I mean, the great thing about this question is that scripture is full of it. And then if you move, you know, I mean, there's discussion of the Old Testament, but just we're flying at 10,000. If you move to Jesus, Jesus is all about overturning power structures of those who are high will be brought down. We look at Luke. Mm-hmm. Those who are low will be brought up. This is in Mary's song, the Magnificat. That's one of the major themes. This is in Jesus' first sermon, right, where he says, you know, I've come to set the captives free and the oppressed. And in Luke's sermon on the plain, where he says, woe to you who are rich, and, blessed are the poor. There's a theme in Luke's gospel, and in all the gospels of the New Testament, right, of bringing down the powerful, bringing up the lowly and the oppressed. And if you think of our modern day context, right, if you look at the, and we can get into some of these details, but if you look at the distribution of wealth and
right.
Distribution of jobs and the way that people are treated when they come to interviews, and if you look at, prison statistics, mm-hmm. and you look at the way people are treated by the court systems, when you look at the history of the United States
right.
through slavery and Jim Crow, and you look at, the way that convicts were turned into, you know, the re-enslavement of black people after the Civil War through convict leasing, right? There's all sorts of things right. that are leading up through time to say, well, if Jesus is on the side of the oppressed and the poor in the Gospels, that there is something that Christians need to be, that Christians in America today need to seriously be considering is, how are we working to live out what Jesus teaches, particularly in Luke, but other places, mm-hmm. Of being on the side of the oppressed and the poor, and what does that look like in America today in the 21st century? I would argue that it looks like taking seriously how black people in the history of the United States and other races. My class, I would say the discussion of black people in America is one of the most pressing questions, but also is things of, you know, like Latinx people and Asian people. And there's all sorts of, I don't mean to limit the discussion to that, but I think that the church in America needs to look at the teachings of Jesus and say, how can we enact those today? And I think sometimes it looks like we need to consider race as something that matters, and that we need to work against forms of racism and white oppression, and white supremacy, and look at how the church can bring about the vision that Jesus has. And then finally, because the last thing, the eschaton is also something that we look forward to in theology. And we look at Revelation, right? It's all over Revelation. Right. There are these ideas of all tongues and tribes and nations worshiping God together. And, you know, it says that specifically, right? And so if that is what the end of time is going to look like, if that is God's good future, and we are supposed to be bringing about the kingdom of God, then it seems like the church should be working towards multi-ethnic, multi-racial, multi-socioeconomic, right, in their churches as much as they can, diversity in their churches as much as they can. And because we know that that's what it will look like at the end of time, we know that that's what God's good future is. And so why don't we start living that out now, right? And so that is the push towards even more than, I mean, you know, there's different levels here, right? There's like one which is just like bare anti-racism, like don't be racist,
right?
You know?
Yeah.
Which is, you know, something that is still a relevant thing in America today to have that conversation. But then there's also the, you know, the Christian idea, which takes that farther and says, not only do we not need to not be racist, but we need to develop deep bonds of spiritual friendship and brotherhood and sisterhood and family, you know, bonds and one body bonds that Paul talks about, that go beyond just sort of not being racist, but going on towards wanting all people, particularly in the church, but all people, right, to be living lives of joy and peace and happiness as much as we can, right? In ways of, even if that means sometimes giving up some of our own to bring that about, which is, again, what Jesus teaches in Luke over and over again.
Mm-hmm. Right. No, that was a great answer, and kind of segues into the next question I want to ask you. And this kind of started coming on the scene for me last fall. I started thinking about it. I read the book Just Mercy by Bryan Stevenson. I don't know if you ever read that.
I've not, no.
Fantastic book. But he was an attorney, a black attorney in Alabama prison system, fighting for death row inmates, predominantly who were black. And it kind of got to the critique there, the reaction that I have heard more from, painting with a broad brush here, but this region of the country, more of the right-leaning.
Sure.
Where it's the critique that, hey, slavery's over, Jim Crow is over, racism is dead. It's just people are harping on about it. But really what it is it's more of almost a lack of responsibility that they're not getting out of these poor neighborhoods. What do you say to that kind of critique?
Yeah, so we're moving a little beyond. So part of the problem as a theologian and people who talk theology, right, is part of what we, you know, where we start and where we end and our core should be, you know, how does the Bible and how does Christian theology speak to these issues, right? Mm-hmm. You see what I'm saying?
Right.
And so, you know, but then there are other pieces, right, which part of being a theologian means, okay, we have these practices, we have these beliefs, we have these teachings, we have this narrative of Scripture, right? And now we look around the world around us and we see, what do we see? And how do we try to bring the kingdom of God to the world around us? Or how do we try to, you know, enact, live out, practice these principles? And again, principles sounds too abstract. These stories, right, that we know of as Jesus wants us to live on this world. How do we honor God? And so so I'm glad we started with a theology piece because this next... The next thing you just talked about was the looking around us piece, right? Like we look around the world, and when we look around, we're all going to see different things, which is why this starts getting controversial, even for Christians. I hope as Christians we can all sort of agree on the things we just talked about, right?
Like, right, right.
You know, anti-racism at a very basic level is clear from Scripture, right? That all human beings are created in the image of God and infinitely valuable. And that should do a lot of the heavy lifting. You know what I mean?
Right, yeah, yeah.
And that if you look at Jesus, right, he's on the side of the oppressed and the poor. Not that being rich you can't get into the kingdom, right? It's just that, like, Jesus has a special heart for the poor and the oppressed. It's clear. And, you know, the orphans and the widows and anyone who is on the outskirts of society. And, in Jesus' time, the Samaritans. And so that's clear. And then the eschaton is clear. But if you want to get... You know, that's why then, so if we can all agree on that, I think the church could actually, we could do some great things. You know what I mean?
Right.
But if you get into the specifics of, like, how do we identify the problems around us, that starts to get more political. And I'm fine with that. And I think the church needs to do that. Just knowing that that is, those questions start to get more complex. And visions of sight. Like here, for let me give you an example really quickly of a vision of sight and how we have different sights, and then then we can talk about some of the actual statistics or things like that. I don't know if you saw, but there was that the trial that just happened in Texas.
Yeah, right.
Where Botham Jean, his name was, I believe.
Yeah, the
black
female
man
white
was killed.
Cop. Okay.
The female white cop. I forget her name off the top of my head.
Yeah, I can't
think of Amber. Amber Geiger, I think her
name
was.
Okay, yeah.
I don't know if you saw this, but there in this story, right, this was a politically charged and racially charged trial because, you know, she came. I'm going to tell you the story from her perspective, right? She came home, she parked her car, she walked into her house, there was a black man sitting on her couch, she pulled out her gun, and she shot him, right? In that last sentence, there's a lot of controversy of what happened, right? Like, But what actually happened was she parked at the wrong level, she went to the wrong apartment, and she ended up shooting someone in his own home, right? And after the police officer, right? So,
right.
And so, you know, she says she's not guilty because she didn't mean to kill him. And there's all these discussions. And you can see how race now gets tied up immediately into this question.
Right.
Where you have a white police officer killing a black man on a couch in his own home, right?
Sure. And this was during the stretch where there was a string of those kinds of news stories.
Sure. Right. Right. Well, there's still, I mean, like that.
Yeah, it's still. Yeah,
this is still a current. This is still happening, right? This is still a very pressing thing, the discussion of race in America today. And after the trial, right, she got convicted, 10 years in prison. She got sentenced to 10 years in prison. And I don't know the exact moment this happened, but somewhere along the line, his brother took the stand and said something like, "I forgive you." Mm-hmm. Did you see this
clip? I saw the video, yes.
Yeah, right. And this is like passing all around social media. Right? Yeah. I forgive you. I want you just to know Jesus, right?
Yeah, and then he wants to give her a hug.
And then he asked the judge, "Can I give you a hug?" And she gave him a hug, and she was just weeping, right?
Yeah.
And the judge was crying, and I think, I don't know. The judge was crying, and then, you know, people are passing this around all the social media sites, right? And so, I'm just saying, these are different visions, right? And this is why these things get so complex. Like, as a Christian, we all want to celebrate and say, like, what an amazing example of forgiveness, right? The power of Jesus to overcome our own desires for vengeance and hatred, right?
Right.
And what a powerful example that this young man gave to the world of mercy and grace and, you know, holding her up as another human, right, creation of God to be loved and cared for, and he wanted her good, not just his. Do you know what I mean? Like,
right.
what a great example. So on the one hand, you know, people are passing this around and saying, what an amazing thing, and
right.
what a glorious moment. And that's a wonderful way to look at this. But, right, as I don't go on Facebook very often, but I have been recently because of this class and trying to sort of get things to think about.
Yeah.
You know, I've got friends who are on there, and they start talking about how this was actually a moment that fit the a different historical narrative, right? This was not necessarily a thing to be celebrated in the abstract, because they argue that this fits with the long history that the United States has of abusing black people and then forcing them or requiring them to forgive their masters. Something like this, right? And that this fits with the slave master mentality, and that really white people should not, like, it's another form of oppression for white people to be celebrating this because it fits with a long history of master-slave relations or something like that, right? Where black people are, where white people can oppress black people, white people can abuse them and oppress them and take advantage of them, and then black people are expected to just forgive and forget, right?
Sure.
Without sort of any repercussions, right?
Sure.
And so I saw a lot of this, you know, so like I'll just read, you know, about this particular, oh, I don't have internet down here. Well, it's fine. how, you know, ways that, so that's another way to view it, right? Trying to contextualize this in you know, the history of the United States and the history of black and white relations, and to contextualize this and say maybe this isn't quite the unabashed good that people originally thought it was. And that's why it's so hard to talk about race in America, right?
Right.
On the one hand, we want to celebrate this amazing thing, but then on the other hand, there's a whole other group of people that are saying, hold on, that's maybe not as good as you thought it was, right? In the abstract. You're a white person and you like celebrating that because it relieves your racial guilt, right? Or you like celebrating that because you like it when black people, you know, sort of forgive white people because then you can do whatever you want. And it's hard because now we have these two different perspectives and like, how are you supposed to look at that thing? So when it comes to, and by the way, I mean, if you want to know my take on that, right? Which I don't, right. I mean, it's hard. I want to celebrate that young man for his forgiveness and honor that.
Right, sure.
In a much higher, at a much higher level than I want to sort of give the other narrative, which I think is probably has some truth to it, mm-hmm. right? That there is a narrative of white people in America expecting black people to forgive and forget without sort of repercussions.
Mm-hmm. Sure.
And so
you saw that after Jim Crow. It was like after slavery.
Right. After, I mean, I don't know, all the time.
Yeah.
You know
yeah.
I mean? Just like point to a time in American history. And so, but I don't want that to be the predominant narrative, right? I want this young man's, example of grace and forgiveness to transcend and just say like, that's a Christian. Right, that's my Christian brother.
Right,
forgiving a woman who he sees as being valuable, and then I want to hold it up and just say like, that's a wonderful thing. Aside from all that other stuff, which may have some truth to it, but I don't want to focus on that. Anyway, so that's my position on that one. When it comes to things like prisons, wasn't that what you originally asked me about?
Yeah,
man, I talk a lot, like, don't just, I? That's well, why I'm a
no,
teacher.
This is perfect. Just talk a little bit about like. From my limited experience in history, I'm not a historian.
That's not my
specialty. But from what I understand, is there's a whole lot more to the story than just slavery and Jim Crow. Like, can you talk about, especially like post Jim Crow, what the experience for a black person is like?
Yeah. So, I think it is the job of. I mean, here's the thing. We're having this interview, and I'm talking as a white male. Just to be very clear, right?
Two white males.
Yeah. Two white males here, right? And so, I mean. My perspective here is, I mean, I'm mostly speaking to white people because that is mm-hmm. my experience, right? In trying to say, like, these are the things that I think matter. Now, the theological stuff at the beginning, that wasn't necessarily just directed to white people.
Right.
But sort of this second section part, right? I mean, I'm speaking as a white person, and so I'm speaking, you know, I'm trying to speak broader than that, but just that's my context. And so, you know, for white people in the United States, we do have a tendency to want to forget what has happened in the past and say that's not us or that's not me. And you know, one of the things is like I can do this one. Like my ancestors did not come to America until after the Civil War, right? Like there was a migration from Germans from Russia to North Dakota, and so like I can be like, ha, I wasn't here. You know what I mean? Like, not my problem. It's a pretty easy cop out, isn't it?
Right. Sure.
And so, but I think that, you know, but I think that's a wrong move for even someone like me whose parents weren't here, right? Because, or whose, you know, grandparents, my parents were, whose ancestors weren't even in America at the time. Because it does ignore that I do have advantages that come with me being white that are historically, that are because of history, right? So I do think you need to look at, Christians, white Christians need to look at our history, and we need to like look deeply into slavery. We need to look deeply into what happened after slavery and Reconstruction, how that failed, and then how we had these, you know, convict leasing systems, and we re-enslaved black people, even though slavery was done on farms, and particularly in the South, where, you know, now it was even worse because they no longer were valuable. You know, an enslaved person was worth, I forget the exact number, it was a lot, 30,000, something like that, right? You know, I mean, again, I hate being put a number on it, but if you put a number on the economic value, it was in the tens of thousands. I forget the exact number off the top of my head. But after slavery was outlawed, right, those convicts that were now leased to farmers no longer had any value because they weren't theirs. They were the state's, right? And so now they could treat them even worse. And that was going on until the early 1900s, right? The early, like, you know, 1915, I think it was going on until, right? And then you have this, and then you have Jim Crow, and then you have, you know, sharecropping. Well, sharecropping, and then Jim Crow, and then you have a whole history of, you know, segregation and the, you know, any way, you know, and then there's voting laws where, you know, black people can't vote, all sorts, for all sorts of reasons, right? And you can't. Black people can't walk down the street without getting arrested if they weren't going to a job or going away from a job. There's a history of terrible mistreatment based on race so that white people could keep privilege and black people stayed in their place, right? And I think we just need to sort of recognize that that is what happened historically and that that still has ramifications today.
Sure.
And in ways that we're not uncomfortable to talk about. It's not like we're all in an equal playing field now, right? I mean, so here's some here's a statistic. I've got a couple here. What is the income, right? Yeah, so like right now, right? The American, if America, all America, the GDP per person is $53,000. If you're black, the GDP of like black America is $23,000, right? Like that's, if you were to like say black America as a country and then all of America, it's just much less. Income, the average household income, right? If you are white in America, it's $70,000. If you're black in America, it's $40,000, $41,000, right? These are from the 2018 Census Bureau.
Okay.
So these are modern, they're good stats, right? And so like that's a huge difference. That's $3,000, right? And you have to start thinking about, like, you know, why is that? I mean, here's something about wealth, too, right? This is really interesting. In the United States, the average wealth per person is $44,000. Wealth just means, like, how much money they have, right?
Okay. So this is not net worth. This is just wealth.
It's like family wealth, okay, right? Okay. For black America, it's $4,000. So that's 10 times the amount of, like, of wealth means, yeah, I mean, it's like net worth. It's like, okay. It's like how much money can you draw upon, right? So that's 10 times. So, and wealth is a historical thing, right? Yeah. That's passed down through generations. And so, you know, there's these massive inequalities that are just statistics,
right?
Like you can't really argue with those, right? There's white people have 10 times more wealth in their families than black people do. And wealth is influenced strongly by families' history, right? Like through time. And so it just makes sense that if the white population in the United States has tried to hold on to money and power and privilege, which it obviously has, right? That's just human nature, that there would still be ramifications today, you know, not very many years after something like you know, the criminal leasing system stopped, right? We're less than 100 years out from that. And so how is it the case that, you know, that stuff is still not affecting us? It affects education. It affects education levels. It affects wealth levels. It affects poverty levels. It affects income levels. It affects, you know, everything. And so for white Americans to think that, like, oh, hey, you know, that was back then, that doesn't matter anymore, is to not have a little bit broader view to say, you know, right now is affected by the past.
Sure.
And in the past, right, it is clear that people made all sorts of judgments and based on race. Like we can think of like redlining. You know, redlining is a practice that was done by the government, right, and by local realtors that would say, you know, they have these ratings. They have these ratings where you would say, if you own a house. It was for mortgages. You know, if you want to buy a house, no one has enough money to buy a house in the cash. So you go to a bank and you say, I want to buy this house. They go look at the house and they say it's worth this much, and they'll say, okay, pay us this much, give us a down payment, we'll give you the rest of the money, and now you can buy this house, right? But the banks created a system that would rate the neighborhoods, and the neighborhoods were based on the color of people in it. And so you could get a mortgage if you were in an all-white neighborhood because they assumed that the land value would hold its value through time, right?
Right.
But the bank would not want to give you a mortgage if there were black people in the neighborhood because they thought that that would mean that the value of the house would start dropping. And here's the really sad part. That was true.
Right.
White people would not pay money for houses where black people lived. And if a black family lived in a neighborhood, the price would drop 10%, 15%, right? So the bank would lose money because they'd now, if they got defaulted on, they'd have to sell their house for a less amount of value. And so they would literally draw lines around neighborhoods where they would say, like, white people, like, this we'll give mortgages in this neighborhood because white people live here. We won't give mortgages in this neighborhood because black people live here. And they might, or they might move here.
Do you know what I mean?
And so that means that now you can't get a mortgage if you're a black person, which means that you can't accumulate wealth because you're just renting, and now you pay your rent to the white person who can own the thing. And so now, because they could get a mortgage, you know, maybe for an apartment building or something.
Right.
And so then, again, it just plays into the ideas of, so now black people are living, they're living in you know, rentals, so they can't accumulate that sort of housing wealth. And then, you know, how are schools funded? Through property taxes.
Right.
And so now you don't have high property values, so you don't have high property taxes, which means your schools aren't funded very well, which means that now, you know, black people's kids are going to poor schools where there's no money to fund proper education. And so now that continues a cycle. Do you see what I'm saying? Like,
right.
These are deep and cyclical and institutional forms that are, you know, things that are affecting people. And so on the one sense, you want to say, oh, everyone's got equal opportunity, right? We all want to say that. I mean, like, right. That's what you want. But if you look at the reality of the situation, like, that's not equal opportunity, right? If you have a white family who can get a mortgage and now live in a nice neighborhood, and now that they can send their kids to the good schools that are funded really high, and then you look at a black family who can't get a mortgage, so they have to send their kids to, they have to live in a poor neighborhood, so then they send their kids to the poor school. Now those two kids are on very different tracks, aren't they?
Right.
And so we want to say it's equal opportunity, but you're like, that's not equal opportunity. That's something else.
Sure.
And so I think the white church in particular, white people in particular, right, need to realize the history that we have that does lead privilege, that does give privilege to white people in ways that are not clear at first. If you're just like, hey, I want to work hard, I got the same opportunities, this guy's got the same opportunities as me, and we're all equal. And that's just, to me, is historically blind in some, you know, in a lot of ways. Now, I do think that there is a rising question of white poverty, particularly in Appalachia, which more and more people are starting to talk about that. You know, where there is deep-seated and long stretches and familiar histories of poverty in, I mean, Appalachia is the one that's being studied right now, where, you know, the drug problem is right. Going, you know, of opioids is okay. Just out of control. And so there is a pushback that says, listen, I'm white and I'm poor and I don't have any privilege. And I think that's a valid feeling.
Sure.
You know what I mean?
Yeah.
And I think that people who talk about race also need to talk about that and say, the privileges that have gone to a lot of white people are may not be flowing to rural, poor Appalachia. Mm. And so that for us to say, like, ha, you're white and you're privileged, is not going to resonate with people, you know, right. who are growing up in equally poor, equally, you know, lack of opportunity neighborhoods that, you know, young black kids, like I was talking about earlier, growing up into, right? And maybe even worse, because now their neighbors are addled drugs, and, you know, right, the men right. are overdosing and dying, and in the same way that, you know, black men are going to prison in massive amounts.
Right.
And that's not, again, that's, I mean, there's a debate to be had there, but, you know, not necessarily because they're more criminal, just because of the way that the criminal justice system currently works, which is still based on, you know, well, yeah, with the criminal justice.
You're saying with the drug mass incarceration over the drug,
right? Use with black because families the, of days. All right. I mean, right. You know, there's the statistics on that are ridiculous. I was just reading an article on this, and I don't want to say. Do I have any examples of this? I'm trying to think if I have any notes with me on incarceration. This is actually the thing I'm working on next, is trying to figure out some more of these incarceration rates. Yeah, here we go. I mean, you know, if the incarceration rate for a white, just say all the United States, is 700 people per 100,000. If you're a black man, it's 4,300, right? So it's, you know, 7 times 420. It's like six times,
yeah.
Right? It's six times the rate for just a normal American.
Right.
If you're a black man, you're six times more, right? And if you are, I mean, something like this, I think I just read this statistic. If you are a black man in America without a high school education, you have a 70% chance of being in prison sometime in your life.
Sure.
A non-high school graduate, black man.
Yeah.
Like, those stats are depressing.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Yeah. And you're like, why is that? Is it because in some reason black people are more criminal? I mean, if you take the theology point seriously, we just did earlier, that is not the case. They're created in the image of God, right?
Right.
So why is it the case that now America is criminalizing them at whatever, six times the rate, incarcerating them at six times the rate of just any other American?
Right.
And you have to start thinking deeply about that. Why is that? You know, I mean, I hope as Christians we're not going to say it's because they're more criminal.
Right, right, yeah.
Right? They, you know, black people just have a tendency to create more crimes because of something innate in them. That seems like that's extremely anti-Christian and doesn't fit any of the biblical narrative, right? That, oh, they are, that's just the, what's just in their DNA or something, right? That's wrong. I think that's anti-Christian and non-theological. So then you say, well, what is it, right? Well, then you have to start, maybe it is some of these factors of, you know, lack of non- opportunity for educational achievement, or maybe it has to do with, you know, poverty levels, or maybe it has to do with of them being criminalized at higher rates because there's racism inherent in the criminal justice system, right? There's,
sure.
There's lots of things you can point at. But at the very least, white Christians need to think about that bare fact of why is it that we criminalize, that we incarcerate black men six times more than we do everyone else? And Christians cannot say it's because they're more criminal.
Right.
You might say they commit more crimes, but then why do they do that? It's not because they're somehow inherently more criminal. What's causing them to commit more crimes? Well, something about society, something about what we're doing, right? And then we need to think, well, then how can we as Christians try to overcome some of those things, right? And particularly the white church, like, what is the white church doing about that? You know, all the church, but it's easy for the white church to sort of ignore that and be like, that's not my problem.
Right.
Anyways.
Yeah, no, that's fantastic. We can keep talking about this all day. It's terribly fascinating. Real quick, though, you had when I talked to you yesterday or Wednesday or whatever it was, you said you had a couple resources. Because from what I'm hearing you say, the first step, especially for the white church, is to learn some empathy and to learn the correct history and current history.
Yeah.
And understand the current cultural moment we live in. What are some of those resources that would be that you would recommend?
Yeah, I mean, I've been reading through some of those resources in this class, right? And I don't love them, but I think there's one called White Awake is a book we're reading, which I think is...
White Awake?
White Awake.
White Awake, okay.
Which is not going to give you the history.
Okay.
Right? To get the history, here's the problem. You're going to have to read multiple books.
Right.
Does that make sense?
Right.
But White Awake, I think, can help someone who's interested in these questions at least start to think, like... White Awake is basically a personal journey from someone who thinks, boy, I need to pay more attention to these topics and what do they mean, and he walks a white person through, right, like, you know, the different steps, like, you know, the first step is you know, I forget what they all top of my head, but it's like recognizing there's a problem, and then, you know, if then you want to reject that there's a problem, and then, you know, then you're unsettled about it, and then you mean, so that he walks you through,
right,
sort of what it means to move from sort of ignorance about this topic to being more aware of it. I think the steps he sets out are helpful for someone's like personal journey. If you want to know more about like what's going, I mean, about sort of today, there's a book I really like. I don't know if she's a Christian, so that's my first warning to this one, right?
Correct.
But if you just want to know some of the statistics and things about today, the book is called Why Do All the Black Kids Sit at the Lunch Table Together? And to get the second edition, because that's a recent one.
Second edition.
The second edition of that one. I think that's a really... I've been reading that. It's been really helpful for me to sort of think of these issues from a black perspective.
Right.
And think deeply about them. If you want to think about a sort of a controversial theological one, it's called The Cross and the Lynching Tree. We're going to read that one coming up.
Okay.
It's thinking about how are the cross and the lynching tree, right? Because we didn't even talk about lynching in the United States, right? Which is another thing you need to learn the history about if you want to think deeply about these things. And he talks about the history of the lynching tree and then how, you know, how the symbolism of that can be tied to the symbolism of the cross. That's a really interesting book. There's one, I think, if you're interested about incarceration, called The New Jim Crow.
Okay, I've heard of that one.
Yeah, that's a book that is worthy of reading and thinking about. I mean, and that right there, I think, is going to be enough, right? I mean, and there's more. If, you know, they're in TFCU students want, like, feel free to email me, and I can lead you down any, you know, paths that are more specific,
right?
You know, for what you're interested in. But those will be some of the good ones. And then there's one I read. Oh, I forgot what it was. It was about the, you know, the criminal. it was like slavery by another name, I think is what it's called. It's, it's about this convict leasing system.
I think
that's what it's called, slavery by another name. I don't know, but it's about the convict leasing system after the Civil War, and that's just a depressing read. I mean, it's good and well written, but it's just like depressing to think about how hard people, you know, in Georgia and Mississippi and Alabama worked to reassert white power through enslaving black people, right? Re-enslaving them.
Right, and this was not when they were no longer considered their property.
Right, yeah, right. It's just depressing to read that.
Yeah.
But important for our understanding of what has gone on in history. So those are some things I would point to. There's a lot of interesting work being done by black theologians who are trying to think about race in new and interesting ways. You know, Willie Jennings, J. Cameron Carter. Now, those are really deep thinkers, but I don't necessarily would not to recommend them
to
anybody. They're not super accessible, but they're good.
Okay.
And there are others I can point to, but I think a good place to start, if you're white listening, this would be Wide Awake.
Wide Awake.
And then I can, like those other, if you're someone like a person of color listening to this, then, you know, some of those other, like J. Cameron Carter and Willie Jennings and others would be really interesting.
Okay.
And then here's one thing I just want to recognize too, is we haven't even talked about, you know, Latinx people or Asian,
which
is a whole.
I didn't figure we'd probably quite get around.
And so
to that.
My apologies to any Latinx people out there who are like, hey, what about me?
Mm.
I mean, we talk about it in the class, right?
But we have to have you back.
Yeah,
on
just
again,
for a day.
Or
what about Asian people? Like, what about me? You know what I mean? It's like,
yeah,
I don't know.
We'll have to have you back on. You talk about that.
Yeah, maybe.
Always a pleasure to sit with you and talk with you. I really appreciate you coming on.
Yeah.
And we have there's one last thing. We like to give all of our guests a loaf of homemade bread. This is from Hirschberger's Bakery in Fairplay. They sponsor our show, and they have
thank you.
Awesomely good baked goods.
I'm excited about this. My family will love this.
Yeah. Oh, it's fantastic.
Thanks for letting me come on and just talk nonstop.
Yeah, absolutely. It's a pleasure hearing you talk. So thank you very much for coming by.
All right, thanks.
That was Colin's conversation with Dr. Herringer, and we really appreciate, Colin, you taking time to just sit down and ask him about these important questions. What were some of your thoughts walking away from that conversation?
Yeah, so one of the biggest things, I took his New Testament class last fall, a year ago, but one of the things I appreciated about him then and what I appreciate about him now is his way to take a non-polarizing, informed outlook mm-hmm. on whatever the issues may be, and he just wants to do he wants to be like Jesus. Was very clear with how he taught, with how he acts, and that's what I thought just hearing him talk. It wasn't from a place of political outrage on either side, right or left. It was just an informed opinion about how to bring the kingdom come.
One thing I thought was interesting that he mentioned, and then I remember from when I was able to listen to him in New Testament survey, was that Jesus is on the side of the poor and the oppressed. And I just wanted us to talk about that for a little bit. Dr. Herringer really mentioned this when we looked at the Gospel of Luke in the sermon on the plain or the mountain.
Yeah.
I think it's the plain.
Yeah.
Jesus says, blessed are the poor there, I think. Not even the poor in spirit.
Right,
he just says, blessed are the poor.
And he makes a big distinction there.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And that's something I think in a capitalist society, it's really easy to forget. We always want to know, well, why are you poor? And what decisions did you make that led to your being poor? Well, that's not really what Jesus asked so much. Jesus is always compassionate, and Dr. Herring would even say on the side of the poor and the oppressed, just because they're poor, you know?
Right. And that's what he talked about some, just some of it could be, you know, lack of finances. Some of it could be unresponsible. But he said that at the end of the day, it's Jesus on the side of those who are poor.
Mm-hmm.
And how do we start recognizing those who are poor and who are poor systemically? And he mentioned that for the white folks in Appalachia and then for the black folks as well. Both of them starting off from a poor standpoint that's more systemic than it is responsibility-wise.
Yeah. And I like that he brought out that his ancestors aren't from America. I forget where he was from. But I think it was somewhere in Europe.
Yeah, but his grandparents just settled in South Dakota, just two generations ago or something.
Yeah, so he was like, you know, all this systemic stuff that went on or goes on, but it started a long time ago. He's like, well, I'm not responsible because not only was I not here, my family wasn't here.
Right.
But he said that is not the way to approach solving problems, is saying, because I wasn't here, I'm not responsible for it. I don't think that's what Jesus calls us to at all.
Right, right. No, I agree. And it was just, I appreciated what he said and the different, he brought several statistics along and he's teaching a great class on it. And at the end of the day, I think one of the biggest things for me is just even knowing some of the information that you don't always know of history or of the current state. And some of that stuff, it's just helpful to even just start out at a state of empathy as you go into dealing with these problems and working for redemption in the different systems. And it's a good standpoint to start from, I think.
What I have to think of after hearing this conversation is, you know, when you walk around, like, what's the flag that's on your back? Like, what hat are you wearing? Are you primarily an American? Or are you primarily a businessman? Or, like, are you primarily a Christian? And I think that shapes the way that you're going to approach this stuff. If you're primarily an American, then you want to know, well, why are these people like this? And what led to this? And is it their fault? Or, you know, who's responsible? But if you are primarily a Christian, I think that's a good place to start with empathy and compassion. And I think it puts you in a position where you're willing and able to help people. And you don't always have to try to fix them. You
know? Right, right. Yeah, and that's what his responses, even at the end of the interview, kind of went from a 30,000 foot down to just the practical. But it was just to start with empathy. You don't need to go out and try to fix it all. In fact, sometimes that might even make it worse. But just like you said, he drew from Luke, but just be responsible of areas where your privilege may shine through or things like that. Just walk aware of that. Walk in step with the Spirit and see where that leads you.
Yeah. Love God and love your neighbor. Yeah. Well, thanks for taking the time to ask, prepare and ask those questions to him and have that conversation. And we look forward to having you guys listen to us again next week.
Yeah, it was a pleasure. See you, everybody.